making paychecks in the wrong place.
All right. So, where are we up to?
I left on your bed, so I have no idea where you are. That's where my market was.
We don't have any idea where we're up to. I know where we're up to.
That's where I was. I don't know.
No, we went through all the things that could have happened to Yiftach's daughter.
Yes, we were talking about Yiftach's daughter. Right. Correct. Right. That was our last discussion, was Yiftach's daughter and the various options as to what Yiftach did to his daughter when it says that he fulfilled his oath to her or his oath about her, whether he actually sacrificed her in a literal sense or some newfound concept of...
Jewish monastic life.
Right. Exactly.
Now,
we have one unresolved question that we asked right at the beginning, and we have not discussed. And I left it for the end because it's a segue into chapter 12. Right. And the question that's unresolved is, did Yiftach have an option, no matter what this oath meant? Whatever his oath about his daughter was conceptually, did Yiftach have an alternative option?
So we talked about why couldn't he do Hadarat?
Right. And the alternative option that he would have had, let's say, halachically, if he was thinking halachically, but even if he wasn't thinking halachically, at least the conceptual framework of the idea is the same, would be to say, I made a mistake. The oath is a ridiculous statement to make. Whatever its interpretation was, he certainly didn't intend for it to be his daughter. We know that he doesn't intend for it to be his daughter because his expression of shock is clear and genuine. Did he have an alternative option for, call it, wiggling his way out of this oath? In legal framework terms, in halachic terms, we would call that Hatarat Nedarim. What is Hatarat Nedarim? We do it every year before Yom Kippur, before Shoshana. Yeah, you go to you convene a Beis Din, and you say, I did not have in mind when I took this oath, I did not anticipate the consequences as articulated, and therefore I regret having taken the oath, and please annul the oath for me, and they do, and they have that power. So whether or not he understands the legal framework to that concept, the question still remains, what option may he have had? And in fact, there's even a textual indication that he considered for a moment the possibility that he did have an out, but that he couldn't take it. Why? So let's go back to 2 Sukkim, in Perek Yud Aleph, when he confronts his daughter at that moment when Bat Yiftach emerges from the house. Starting with Pasuk Lamed Daleth. Let's go back to these psukim. Vayavo Yiftach ha-mitzpa el beito, v'hinei bito yotzet likvato, b'tupim uv'imcholot. Comes home, daughter comes out to greet him with the drums and with dancing. We talked about this as well. V'rak hi yichida en lo mimenu ben ovat. The tragedy of her being alone or an only child. He sees her, he tears his garment. You are my trouble, you have brought me down. I uttered this declaration to God, therefore I cannot retract. In her response, Vatomer Elav, Avi, Patsita et Picha El Hashem, Aseli Gahashe Yatzami Picha. If you have opened your mouth to God, then do to me as you have expressed. And then the rest of the story is the continuation of what happened to Bat Yiftach. So there seems to be an emphasis on both sides, both Yiftach's declaration and her response to Yiftach's declaration seem to revolve around one concept, namely that which he uttered he cannot retract. That which he declared unto God, an oath, Patsiti Pel Hashem, I opened my mouth to God, that can't be retracted. even though we know technically and conceptually it can be retracted, especially if it's based on error. And there's enough circumstantial evidence here to suggest that the oath was either not valid in the first place, or that he never anticipated that this would happen. He didn't anticipate that his daughter would come out, or that anybody would come out. Whatever the answers that we have heretofore suggested, clearly I think he has enough evidence to say, let me do something. I know this oath. This question essentially forms the basis of much of the discussion in the halachic literature around Yiftach's story.
What about the bystanders, the people that were standing by? I mean, doesn't anybody? I mean, it's like when someone's getting hurt or killed. I mean, there are bystanders around. Were they not responsible, or did they not take action?
So I don't know how much the rank and file are accountable for that, because they're not really involved in the leadership. You know, Yiftach is the head of the tribe, he's the shofet, he's the melech. And I'm not sure that the people are so culturally attuned to the tragedy here. Remember that if people are no less assimilated pagan idolatrous than Yiftach is. But if there is somebody who is expected to be accountable here, besides Yiftach, and that's really where Chazal enter into the picture. Chazal throw into this equation a particular individual who should have been held accountable, or should have responded here.
Right.
And we're going to see who that individual is in a second. This is the opening of a very interesting story, which on the face of it is based on a certain level of midrashic introduction into the story. And what I want to demonstrate today and continue next week is where this actually intersects with the text of the story itself. But just going back for a moment, what is the mechanism? What would, if we were to look at it from a halachic perspective, what would be the answer to the question of why didn't Yiftach annul the oath? So there is, and in order to understand where the Medrash comes into the picture, we have to understand certain halachic principles. Chazal, in midrashic discussions of these stories, always talk in halachic literature, in halachic terms. Whether they're applicable back into the arena of Yiftach historically is questionable, but they always talk in halachic terms. What are the halachic issues here? Let him annul the oath. The answer that they give is not every oath can be annulled in every circumstance. There are parameters to the legal framework of Hatarat Nedarim. So, for example, I'm going to give out a source page and we'll just pass that down. So, for example, we have, and I'm just giving you examples of concepts. Which one of them is applicable to Yiftach, we'll see in a moment. But if you take a look on the bottom half of this page, where it says, Shulchan Aruch Yerodea Simon Reish Chaf Chet. This chapter in the Shulchan Aruch are the laws of Hatarat Nedarim. The laws of Hatarat Nedarim are not unique to Rosh Hashanah. They apply any time of the year, and they apply under many different types of circumstances. So here, based on the Gemara, based on a lengthy discussion in the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch introduces two concepts that are relevant to the laws of oaths. The first is Nadar al dat chavero. If a person takes an oath with another person's consent or public knowledge, right? Which is, it's not my oath. If I take an oath and I regret the oath or the circumstances change, I can go to a Beis Din and I can annul the oath. But if I took an oath together, let's say, with somebody else, or in the presence of somebody else, so that I'm no longer the private, just me alone subject involved in this oath, then the halacha is ein matirin lo ela im kein hodiol la otoshen adar al da'ato. So if I took a note together with Yaakov, then in order for me to annul the oath, I have to either bring Yaakov along or inform him or engage him. The moment he is involved in that oath in some way, publicly, or he's aware of it, or he heard it at the time, he becomes a kind of quasi-partner to that oath. I can't annul it by myself. I no longer have that authority. I've involved a second person. I have to in some way inform him or involve him in that process. That's an oath between two people. What happens? Sixth. What happens if I expand the awareness to be an oath not in the presence of, with the knowledge of another person, but in the presence of or with the knowledge of an entire community or an entire people? So there the Shulchan Aruch writes in Siv Chaf Aleph, Neder Sha'aldat Rabim, if I take an oath publicly, if I expand the parameter of Neder Aldat Chavero to Neder Aldat Rabim, an oath taken in a public arena, then Ein lo hatara b'lo da'atam. Then I can't annul that oath without the consent of the entire public. Now, there's a qualification to that. He goes on, he says, Elam kin yesh mitzvah b'hatarato, unless there's a reason, a mitzvah that requires it to be annulled, and there are other parameters too. However, this principle of neder al da'at rabim, oath taken in a public arena, becomes the subject of discussion with regards to Yiftach. Why?
This was a public arena.
Right, because there's no greater, more public arena than the general in the height of battle who brings before the entire army, they're about to go into battle, and he makes a public declaration, God, give them this enemy into our hands, and if you do, I will do X, Y, and Z. Which Adina dovetails into the question you asked. Right, where is everybody else? The answer is that they were partner to the oath. So if they're partner to the oath, in a sense, they're probably of the same mindset that Yiftach is. Partner to the oath, whatever the consequences of the oath are, you need to address.
And he needs those people if he wants to get out of the situation. Also.
And he needs those people. He needs those people in order to get out of the situation, possibly. Right? Now take a look at the Ramah. I'll show you why I say possibly. Take a look at the Ramah, which is the second line in the small print. Hagah, v'yesh machmirim dafilu im da'atam ein lahatir l'dvar harishut. There are those who say that if you take an oath publicly, like Nedal Dat Rabim, assuming that it's an optional oath, not related to a requirement of a mitzvah, then you can't annul it because you can never get the full consent of the. Yeah, you can never get everybody back. You can never get the full consent of the rabbim which was involved in the oath in the first place.
This is when Twitter is very good.
Right, but this is before Twitter, so I guess they didn't have Twitter. So Chazal had to come up with some answer other than.
The only positive thing I can see. So I'm trying very hard.
This is Chazal had to come up with some resolution. We'll talk about what they came up with for Yiftach. But this is the problem in a purely legal terminology. Yiftach's oath falls into the category of a public oath. The question now becomes: can you annul a public oath? This, of course, assumes that the oath is valid and that the circumstances are such that the oath could be applicable, etc. But putting all that aside, because we've discussed that, is there an option for Yiftach to annul this oath or to involve, go through some kind of process parallel to the halachic framework of annulling the oath, especially if it's taken publicly? And here Chazal come up with a very intriguing answer. If you do take such a public oath, and there's no option because you can't gather the community together, is there an alternative?
A rove.
Excuse me?
A rove.
A rove. Right, majority. Or?
Go to the Kohen Gadol.
Right.
Wow, good guess.
Right. In other words, you go to an individual, right? You go to the individual who represents the Kohen. who represents the Kahal. If you can't get the community together, if you can't get the people together, then you gather the then you get the individual who represents the single largest collection of the community of Israel, which is either, as Adina correctly says, the Kohen Gadol, or well, the Beitin can be a local. You could possibly go to the Sanhedrin, but there is no Sanhedrin at this point in time yet. Or, other than the Kohen Gadol, who represents the community?
The king.
And or, if you're talking about before monarchy, the Shofet. The problem here for Yiftach is, he is the Shofet. So he doesn't have the option of going to the Shofet of the Melech, but he does have the option of going to the Kohen Gadol. And here Chazal interject into the story what seems to be a very anachronistic statement, and I'm going to share it with you because I want to go this is really with the beginning of our story. The suggestion that Yiftach had an option. And the tragedy of the story of Yiftach is a tragedy built upon a tragedy. Namely, the first tragedy is, of course, what happens to his daughter. And the second tragedy is that it need not have happened. Because there was an option for him. But the option wasn't taken. And so our question...
Could have made a different vow to begin with.
Right. Well, that's
less speculative.
Yeah, right. But that, assuming once we're into that, already we're there, then was there an option? And here Chazal add, in a sense, suggests that there's an additional level of tragedy involved. And that's where one
of the options that were available.
That he didn't take advantage of the options available, and the question is why. So what is the option? Now take a look at the source, the first source. This is a Medrash in Bereishit Rabbah, and it's quoted often. Ramban quotes it. Many of the Mefarshim quotes it. It's a very famous conversation. You'll often hear. It's even entered into modern Hebrew colloquialism. Called the Pinchas Yiftach syndrome. Says the Medrash, Bereishit Rabbah, after a lengthy discussion about this oath, and remember, Chazal were of the opinion that he actually sacrificed her on an altar. And the Medrash therefore asks, if Velo Hayasham Pinchas Shiatilu et Nidro, wasn't Pinchas around? Pinchas the Kohen Gadol? To annul the oath? Now, before we go on with the Medrash, let's just talk about Pinchas for a second. Who is Pinchas and how did he enter the picture?
Was this the Pinchas
that
drove
the...
Correct. Pinchas ben Eleazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Pinchas, grandson of Aaron the Kohen. Pinchas' story, the zealousness of Pinchas, the story of Zimri stabbing the etc. Says the Medrash, Pinchas is the Kohen Gadol. Why wasn't he there to null the oath? We'll come to the answer in a second. But there's an anachronistic challenge in this Medrash. Why?
Because was he still around?
Well, how old would he be if he's still around?
I don't know.
Yes, you do. You all do. If you read the story with us, you should know. Just got to think it through.
I remember.
Think through Pinchas. Think through Yiftach's dialogue with the king of Ammon.
That's
that didn't even sound like a cell phone. That sounded like a real old-fashioned phone.
Definitely gets your attention, though. Unlike mine, which I always miss. I'll never even hear my phone.
How many years are we here from the story of Yiftach? A story of Pinchas. How many years later? Yiftach said it when he was negotiating with the king of Ammon.
Oh.
And he said to him, where were you for the last
400 years?
300.
300?
300.
Okay.
Right. Shlosh Meot Shana. He says, where were you for the last 300 years? Yeah, especially when you're dealing with lifespan. Right? In other words, we have textual proof that we are 300 years from the story of Ammon and Moab, which is the same period of time as with the Battle of Sichon, the same story, period of time as the story of Pinchas. We're 300 years later. So are we suggesting for a moment that Pinchas was 300 years old?
Plus.
300 plus.
So maybe it's B'nai Pinchas.
But Chazal were very specific about Pinchas. And the proof to the fact that they were very very specific about Pinchas is that they bring proof text that not only was he there, but that the punishment for his role in this story was that he was defrocked.
Pinchas.
I thought he could be
from the Kahuna Gedola. Kahuna Gedola. Thank you. Kahuna Gedola. See what you did to me? From the Kahuna Gedola. Correct.
Defrocking.
Right? Yeah. He was defrocked. That's the end of this message.
That definitely sounds like a nasty word.
There has to have been a fight.
Right. Well, so how did he end up in the story? Where did Chazal find him 300 years later? We've read through the story so far. I haven't seen his name.
Maybe it's using him as a concept.
So that's one possibility, that we're talking about the Kohen Gadol in generic terms, but not Pinchas, although Pinchas is a very specific individual, right? If you want to talk about the Kohen, you can talk about Aaron, you can talk about anybody. Why it's Dafka Pinchas? I think the answer is that Pinchas, as a persona, is a very powerful presence in the Book of Shoftim. Why do I say that?
Even at the age of 300.
Why do I say that? Take a look at the next two stories later. The end of Sefer Shoftim, which is going to be our subject of our agenda and syllabus for study next year. But the last story in Sefer Shoftim is a tragedy called Pilegesh Begiva. Mm. Wow. Familiar with it?
Mm. Right.
Pilegesh Begiva is a very very dramatic tragedy on all kinds of fronts. But take a look in Perek Chaf. In Perek Chaf, they go to war with Binyamin. Why they go to war with Binyamin is internal to the story there. But starting with, we can start from the beginning of the parak. It's just to give you a context. Ve'etzu kol b'nei Yisrael v'tikahel ha'eda ki'ish echad l'midan v'yad ber sheva ve'eretz ha'gilad el Hashem ha'mitzpah. All of Israel gathered together, all of the tribes of Israel as one, 400,000 soldiers to go to war against Binyamin. One of the civil wars in Sefer Shoftim. The result, end result, was the near annihilation of the tribe of Binyamin. Now, part of the tragedy there is they go to the Kohen Gadol twice to ask him his advice about this war, and both times he tells them to go to battle against Binyamin, and both times Binyamin wins the campaign. Which is really a remarkable story militarily, but when we get to that story, we'll talk about it. Who is the Kohen Gadol who quote-unquote fails them twice in the story of Pilegesh Begiva? Take a look in Pasuk Chavchet. Perek Chav, Pasuk Chavchet. We're starting with Pasuk Chavzayin. Vayish'alu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem, v'sham Aron brit elokim b'yamim ahem. They went to Hashem, they asked him, they went to the Aron. Ufinchas ben Elazar ben Aron omed lefanav b'yamim ahem. Kohen Gadol by the name of Pinchas ben Elazar HaKohen. They said, should we go to war? And he said, yes. And the rest of the story is not relevant to our discussion. In other words, we have clear evidence that Pinchas is alive and well and is in fact serving as the Kohen Gadol in Perek Chaf of Sefer Shoftim. Well, it stands to reason, if he's around as the Kohen Gadol in Perek Chaf, he's the Kohen Gadol in Perek Yudalev. And you'd bet. That's the rationale behind the basis of the question of Chazal, where was Pinchas? If we know that Pinchas is the Kohen Gadol in Pilegesh Begiva, he's still around. How he's still around, interesting question. It's one of the reasons why Chazal identified Pinchas with another individual of longevity. Chazal of Midrashically link Pinchas to another individual of longevity by the name of
Eliyahu.
Correct. Pinchas Eliyahu.
Oh, okay.
And the reason they connect him to Eliyahu is because Eliyahu is the only other persona in Tanakh who's called a kanoi, who's a zealot. Well, himself describes himself as a zealot. Kano kaneti l'Hashem l'keisa. So there's a thematic link between them. And here Chazal saw Pinchas living 300 years. He's around in the story, Pelegesh Begiva. The only other individual who has such longevity is the only individual who didn't die in Tanakh, went up to Shemayim in a chariot of heaven, assuming that means he didn't die. So Pinchas u Eliyahu. And in fact, that's what the Radak, in source 4, the Radak explains this specifically. He says, V'yesh min abatenu she'amru, the second paragraph, V'yesh min abatenu she'amru pinchas ze Eliyahu, ve'emet ki pinchas chaya yamim rabim. Chazal identified Pinchas with Eliyahu, and the source is the fact that he lived for many years. He's around in this next story. Now, from a Pshat perspective, I have a solution that I have an alternative option for how Pinchas ends up in the story of Pelegesh Begiva without having to resort to the fact that he's 300 plus years old. From a Pshat perspective, the answer is that Pelegesh Begiva is a very early story. It's chronologically out of sequence. By a few hundred years. It's actually from the very early period of Sefer Shoftim. Why it's the end of the story, why it's the end of the book, that's part of our study for next year. Right. But midrashically, Chazal understood the stories in sequence, saw Pinchas in Pelegesh Begiva, saw him as the Kohen Gadol, and saw in the story of Yiftach a dramatic failure on the part of Pinchas and Yiftach. How do they understand the failure? Now let's go back to the Medrash that we started with. Say that again?
I said you need so much information to fill in all the blanks. It's just,
That is true. That's part of the beauty and challenge, right?
The more
I learn, the less I know.
Yes,
that's
the truth.
You're not the only
one. Really?
No. Oh,
everything. Okay.
All right, says the Medrash. V'lo ayashem Pinchas yatilo et nidro. What happened to Pinchas? Says the Medrash. Ella. So, just to understand the picture. We have this Pinchas, Kohen Gadol, and we have Yiftach, Shofet, and we have an oath that requires them to get together in order to deal with, resolve. Says, listen to this. This is wild. Ela Pinchas amar, hu tzarich li, v'ani alech etzlo.
Oh, I've never heard that before.
Give me a break.
I need to go to Kohen Gadol. I need to go to him. He has to come to me. Says Pinchas. I'm the Kohen Gadol. He needs my help. He needs me to annul his oath. I'm here in my office. Let him come. V'yiftach amar, ani rosh k'tzinei Yisrael. I'm the melech. I'm the shofet. V'ani alech etzlo. I'm going to go to Pinchas. Let him come to me. He's the Kohen Gadol. He should be subservient to the melech. So Pinchas is sitting in his office. Yiftach is sitting in his office. Between the two of them, bendin the din of Dahanarahi. Between the two of them, the maiden perished. Because of the arrogance of the position of each. Now,
you don't think that's ever happened before?
All the time. We call it, we even have a name for it. We call it a Pinchas Yiftach syndrome.
We got plenty of them.
Right? They want me to help them, let them come to me. They need my assistance, right? The arrogance is mind-blowing. And concludes, it's also very real, which is part of what Midrashim were. They were very real understanding of human nature in the way Chazal read these stories.
Seems to me that's a good Drasha.
Mm-hmm. Vishnehemne and Shub in the Mea Shel Na'ara. Both Pinchas and Yiftach were accountable for her death. Yiftach, now how is Yiftach punished? Yiftach met b'nishilat evarim. Yiftach died through a very grotesque, horrible disease in which his limbs fell off, literally one by one. And the basis of that is a textual nuance. B'chol makom sheya olech bo haya, sheya olech bo haya ever nishol mimenu. Excuse me? Yeah. V'hayu kovrin oto sham, as it says, v'yamot yiftach v'yikaver ba'are gilad. V'ir gilad lo nemar ela ba'are gilad. The end of the story, it says that Yiftach died 6 years, he reigned for 6 years, and he died in the cities, and he was buried in the cities of the Gilad, in the plural. How do you bury somebody in the plural?
Everything dropped.
Exactly right. I'm less interested right now in the Yiftach side of the equation as I am in the Pinchas side. Pinchas nitla mimenu ruach hakodesh. Pinchas was defrocked. Ruach hakodesh, the power of Kohuna, the power of the Kohen Gadol, was removed from him. How do I know? Because of a pasuk in Devar Hayomim that says, Pinchas ben Elazar nagidaya lehem. Pinchas ben Elazar was the ruler over them. He was the Kohen Gadol. Hu nagid alehem en k'tiv kan. It doesn't say he is the ruler. It says, Aya nagid, he was the ruler. Lifanim Hashem imo. God was with him, used to be with him. There was a past tense to this verse implied, and therefore the indication is that he was let go, fired, deposed, based on demoted. His failure here. Now,
but there's a difference between demoted and all your limbs falling off.
No, Pinchas, that doesn't happen to Pinchas, that happens to Yiftach.
Oh.
Yiftach is the melech, is the warrior, he dies.
No, but I'm saying, look at the difference of the different things. That
look at the difference in the role, right? Yiftach is the one who made the oath, Yiftach is the one who sacrificed. You can't compare. Right? Pinchas is just guilty of arrogance, but Yiftach is guilty of murder.
But
there's a difference between them.
That's a big punishment.
That is a big punishment. Now, two things about Yiftach's punishment. Number one, typically, midrashim like this, and we've talked about this before, are misplaced. Meaning, Chazal do this a lot. They'll take a medrash from one part of Tanakh and bring it over to another part of Tanakh. We've talked about this in some various contexts in Yeshua. The most famous example is the story of Avraham in the fire in the furnace of Nimrod, which is a borrowed story from the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 3. Other examples, the story, the Medrash about Moshe looking for his lost sheep, and that being the method by which God chooses him as the leader, which is the story of borrowed from Shaul looking for his donkeys and how he finds Shaul and how he finds Shmuel, and Shmuel says to him, "You're going to be the king of Israel," which is in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet. Many of such examples where Chazal took stories from one part of Tanakh, superimposed them onto the other in order to draw connections. Yiftach, Pinchas's failure, for which he ultimately loses his position as the Kohen Gadol, is in Tanakh. It's just not here. The failure of Pinchas is the story of Pelagish Begiva. And that's what we're going to look at in much more detail next year. Clearly he's the Kohen Gadol there, explicit in the text. Clearly he fails because he sends them into war twice and both times they fail, and it's a civil war. So his failure is in the Urim V'Tumim, his failure is in the position of the Kohen Gadol, and therefore it makes sense that the result is, as we saw in the Pasuk, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen haya Kohen b'yamim ahem. He was in those days the Kohen Gadol, but not subsequent to it. How Chazal saw the role of Pinchas here in the story of Yiftach remains to be seen. But they hold Pinchas accountable for not annulling the oath. They hold Yiftach accountable for not going to annul the oath. Now, Pinchas' role will come to. But I want to come back to Yiftach. Why doesn't Yiftach go to Pinchas? Why doesn't Yiftach want to annul the oath? What's his issue?
Where was he, first of all? When he goes back home, it's not, you know, he wasn't Eretz Tov, but then they say, well, if you take on...
He lives in the Gilad. Mitzpah's in the Gilad, right here.
So he comes back into... Mitzpeh
Gilad, somewhere in here.
So he moves back.
Correct.
So he's not that far.
Yeah, Shiloh is here.
not that far. You just have to cross the Yarden. Not so terrible.
He must have had a grudge. He didn't want to go. He was angry.
Possibly a grudge.
He did something to him and he wasn't going to.
Maybe. Lose face, maybe?
Lose face. Another possibility. All possibilities, but we have no. But we need something concrete.
Maybe he doesn't think he's going to be successful.
Maybe. Maybe just pure arrogance. I'm the king. Right? Yiftach's arrogance,
before,
right?
That it was arrogance.
I mean, the Midrash, basically, it sounds just like total arrogance.
Yeah.
Right?
He was above.
Above. That's right. The truth is that the Melech Kohen conflict is not new. The Melech Kohen conflict is a very. Is a continual source of tension in biblical history. It's a constant power struggle. Remember that the Kohen is a melech. The Kohen Gadol is a melech. He wears a crown like a melech. He wears gold clothes like a melech. He has Kohen Hedyot servants who are his servants under him. The domain of the Kohen Gadol, the domain of the Kohuna, which is the Mikdash, is the one domain that the melech is not allowed to enter. The melech has no jurisdiction in the Beit HaMikdash. The one melech who violates that domain line, that division, was Uzziah for entering into the Mikdash to bring sacrifices as a Kohen Gadol, as a Kohen, and he was punished for it. So the division between the melech and the Kohen Gadol is a clear division of powers in Tanakh. It's set out in Chumash, it's set out as almost a, not so much a triangle of division of powers, but a, I don't know what they call it, quadruple division of powers. You have the Melech, the Kohen, the Shofet,
and the Navi.
Right? And the Navi. And they're all mentioned in Sefer Shoftim. By the way, there's an acronym to remember them. Melech, Shofet, Kohen, Navi. Are the division of the powers of...
Cool.
And they all revolve
cool.
around the word Mishkan.
It's cool.
Correct.
It's cool.
It's cool. So why doesn't Yiftach right. want to annul this oath? So here's a theory. Here's a theory.
Is this yours?
No. Very few of these chiddushim are mine. But it's written up in an article by Rav Meidan in one of the editions of Megadim. Here's a theory. How many oaths are central to the story of Yiftach? How many oaths, about how many oaths have we studied in this story?
Half a dozen.
No.
Two.
Two. And they are?
One
Yiftach's oath to his daughter, or about his daughter, and the other?
And the other is the people who came to Yiftach to ask him to be the head of the army.
Correct. The other was the oath that put Yiftach into power. The oath taken in Mitzpeh, the people agreed that if Yiftach fights this war, they will allow him, they will make him their leader. Now, what happens if Yiftach goes to the Kohen Gadol and annuls the oath of his daughter?
Oh, would it annul the other one?
Well, it wouldn't automatically, but the precedent is pretty darn dangerous. Imagine for a second, do the people want Yiftach as their leader?
No.
Guaranteed. Nobody wants Yiftach as a leader, and I'll prove it to you in chapter 12. Right? Yiftach is the last person in the world you want as your leader. And the... only reason why they'll tolerate Yiftach as the leader is because they were forced into it on the basis of an oath. And Yiftach knew that they wouldn't do it, so he made them take that oath. Very public. Lifnei Hashem b'mitzvah. That oath was taken before God. That oath was taken in the presence of... What does Lifnei Hashem mean?
In public.
But Lifnei Hashem means either in public or by or before the... Aaron, which means in the presence of the Kohen. A very public oath, taken in the presence of the Kohen, taken in the presence of God. To empower Yiftach's position as a Shofet. Now poor Yiftach Nebach needs to go to the Kohen Gadol to annul his oath about his daughter. Fine, he'll go to the Kohen Gadol. He'll annul his oath, and tomorrow the people will come back to the Kohen Gadol and say, oh, do me a favor, let's do this again. We also have an oath that we really didn't mean, and we really didn't want to have to follow up on, or we really didn't see the circumstances coming.
So we'll get rid of you too.
So Yiftach has a very vested interest in not annulling oaths.
Kidding.
Not if you're a Yiftach.
Oh boy. Well, that's a pretty harsh cold body. That's
by the end of the story, we will see Yiftach is a cold blooded killer.
It's his own daughter.
And all that we have been learning has been building up to an understanding of the drama of Yiftach's evil. It's not about his daughter, it's about chapter 12. And that's what we're going to go to now. But Yiftach's role in this story is tragic, not only because he could have annulled the oath, but his choice not to could very well be interconnected with his drive for power, which is where the story began.
But he's willing to sacrifice his daughter to get that.
It would seem. And Chazal certainly saw it in such terms because they hold him accountable for this oath to the point where he is punished for it ultimately. They clearly saw him as having had an option which he chose not to implement. Now how the Kohen Gadol's role in all of this, that's a story that we don't have enough information to deal with. And the other side of the equation, which I can understand the Yiftach side here, the side of the Pinchas equation and why he doesn't annul the oath and why he doesn't get involved, that piece really needs elaboration in the story of Pelagish Begibah. So I'm going to park that. And we will come back to it. It's in my notes. We'll come back to it when we get to Pelagish Begibah. But that brings us to the beginning of our study of chapter 12. We have arrived. No, I emphasize this so much is because I would bet money that most people, when they think of Yiftach, they only know or they think of the story of Yiftach's daughter. Mm-hmm. If they know the story at all, they know the story of Yiftach's daughter. And their judgment is based on that. Well, very few people know what happens next. And the real piece of this is the next chapter. Vayitzaek Ish, it's very short, just a pasuk Zayin. Vayitzaek Ish Ephraim Perek Yudbet through to pasuk Zayin. Vayitzaek ish Ephraim Vayavor tzafona. Ish Ephraim is a reference to what's Ish Ephraim? What does Ish Ephraim mean? A man from the tribe of Ephraim?
Men of Ephraim.
Meaning Ish Yisrael is a reference to the army of Israel. Ephraim is a reference to either the army or a delegation of the army. The fighting force of the tribe is called Ish. Ish Yisrael, Ish Ephraim in this case. And Vayitzaek Ish Ephraim Vayavor Tzafona. They gathered together and they went Tzafona. Now, I'll bet you various translations will translate the word Tzafona differently. The article translates it as northward.
Tzafona.
Correct?
Cross
to the north. And the Koran Tanakh translates it as across to Tzafon, which is the name of a city. Mm. There's a city in the Gilad called Tzafon. Mm-hmm. So are they going northward or are they going to Tzafon?
They're going north.
North to Tzafon. From where?
From
Ephraim, correct? Here's the problem. Here's the problem. Where's Ephraim?
Up there.
So west.
That's not really.
You don't go north. I mean, you go a little bit north, but not much. You don't go nearly as much as you go east. You cross the river. So to suggest that they're going north is problematic. Therefore, most of the translators understand Tzafon is the name of a city, not a direction. Mm. Right?
Okay.
Hold that thought. We'll come back to it. I have an explanation for why it might be north, but we'll talk about that later. Be that as it may, they come to Yiftach. Vehemuli Yiftach. How dare you go and fight fight with Amon. Vilanu lo karat al alechat imach, without calling us to join you in battle. What do you think? We're a chopped liver? We don't have to a role to play? Betcha nisrof alecha ba'esh. We will burn your house down.
That's a reaction,
isn't it? That's a reaction. Now, this is not the first time B'nai Ephraim have reacted to a shofet going to war without them.
Yeah.
Correct.
I remember.
You remember that. When was the last time B'nai Ephraim reacted to a shofet going... No, but close. Gidon. Go back to the story of Gidon for a moment. And this is important. After Gidon begins his war against Midian,
are we referring back to where?
Perek Zion. I'm sorry, beginning of Perek Chet. Right. Actually, let's go back a little bit to the end of Perek Zion. After Gidon breaks the camp of Midian and he starts the war and he runs after them, he's chasing them. Pasuk of Dalet, Umalachim shalach Gidon b'chol har Ephraim lemor, v'du likrat Midian v'lichdu otam v'lichdu lahem et hamayim ad beit bar v'et yarden. Go, he sends messengers to Ephraim and he says, go and chase the enemy. I've broken the ranks. You will go and chase them, capture them. And Vayitzaek called Ish Ephraim v'el kedu adamayim. And in fact, Ish Ephraim, the army of Ephraim comes and they capture the generals Orev and Ze'ev. That's the story. Then Perakhet. Vayamru elav Ish Ephraim, the men of Ephraim, meaning the army of Ephraim, said to Gidon, Ma davar hazeh asita lanu? What is this that you've done to us? Levilti krot lanu? You didn't call us to war? That you went to fight with Midian without us? How dare you? They fought with him. They strove with him. They fought with him. They were angry at Gidon. To which Gidon's response was, whatever I have done does not come to the heels, that cannot be compared to what you have done. Halo tov olot Ephraim miftziar Aviezer. The young sapling grapes of Ephraim are better than the harvested ripe grapes of Aviezer, my family tribe. Meaning, what does Gidon say to them? God gave into your hands the generals. You had the smiting blow. You had the finishing blow. You had the makar patish. Nothing I have done could compare to what you have accomplished. My dear Ephraim. Az raftaru cham me'alav b'dabro adavar hazeh. Ephraim was appeased. And they went home. Gomim b'chitov. Very nice. Clear?
Mm-hmm.
What does Yiftach do in response to Ephraim's conflict? Same B'nai Ephraim, same Ish Ephraim, with the same argument. Mm-hmm. They come to Yiftach and said, "Betcha nisrof alecha be'esh. How dare you go to war without us? We're going to
burn your house down.
Raise your house to the ground."
That's what they did in the New York Times today. You know, they burned in that Hasidic community.
Did you go there? I missed that story. I'll look at it afterwards.
With gasoline, you put it down the house.
What city? In Brooklyn. Yeah.
Whatever?
In
the post?
Pasuk back to Berak Yibet, Pasuk Bet. Vayome Yiftach Alehem. Homework. Right. Vayomer Yiftach Alehem. Yiftach's response. Compare Yiftach's response to Gidon's response. Ish Riv Hayiti Ani Vami Yuvne Amon Ma'od. Amon and I, we've been at war for many years. And for all the years that we've been at war, at least 18, possibly more, Ve'ezak Etchem, we called you. V'lo sha'atem oti miyadam. And you refuse to help me. And you refuse to save me from their hands. So you know what? Va'er'eh ki encha Moshiach. When I saw that you refused to help, v'asim nafshi b'chapi, I took my life into my own hands. V'abra'u b'nei Amon, crossed over into the territory of Ammon. And guess what? Ma'itnem Hashem b'yadi. God gave them into my hands. How dare you come to wage war with me? In other words, Yiftach's answer to them was, where were you for the last 18 years? For years we've been putting up with Ammon. What, were you sitting at home, enjoying your life? And now you come crying to me? I'll show you. So Yiftach gathers his fighting force, which are now well trained and well experienced in warfare, battle ready, battle tried. And he goes to war with Ephraim.
Different approach.
A little different approach, right? Vayaku anshe Gilad et Ephraim. People of Gilad smote Ephraim. Ki yomru, plitei Ephraim atem Gilad, betoch Ephraim, betoch Menashe. Good luck trying to translate that phrase. They said, Anshe Gilad smote the people of Ephraim because they said, refugees of Ephraim you are, Gilad amidst Ephraim, amidst Menashe. Doesn't make any more sense in English than it does in Hebrew. Leave that aside for a moment. Outcasts, whatever you want to translate the word plitim. I will come back to this phrase, if not today, the next week. It's the centerpiece of the story. But whatever this phrase means, and it's obscure, the result is not. Vayilkod Gilad et ma'abrot ha'yarden le'Ephraim. Gilad, the army of Yiftach, closed off the crossing of the Yarden to Ephraim, thereby trapping them. Ve'ayak yamru plite Ephraim e'evoda, if the soldiers trying to escape the battle, ve'evoha palit ve'aged la'avraham, and the palit is the one who survives the battle. If those who tried to survive, the survivors running away from the battle, tried to cross the Yarden, Vayomrulo, the people of Gilad, had a test to see who they were. They wanted to make sure that they were only going to kill Ephraimites and no Giladites. Vayomrulo anshe Gilad, ha'efratiata? Are you an Ephrati or Vayomrulo? And they would say no. Why would they say no? Because they knew if they identified themselves from Ephraim, they would be killed. Vayomrulo, so they said, emorna shibolet. Say the word shibolet. Ephraim evidently had a different dialect of Hebrew. Right? And their shin was pronounced as a sin, or a samach. So vayomer sibolet. They would answer, sibolet. V'loyachinda deberken. They couldn't speak correctly, quote unquote. So what happened? The moment they were identified as an Ephraimite, running away from the scene of battle, we call them a non-combatant, prisoner of war. Vayachazuoto, they'd grab them. Vayishchatuhu el ma'abrot ha'yarden. And they were slaughtered. Vayipol ba'etahi me'Ephraim arba'im u'shnayim aleph. They slaughtered, and the word slaughter is never used for a description of battle, except here, or rarely used. They slaughtered them. It was a shkita. 42,000 Ephraimites. And if you want to see Yiftach's, the depth of Yiftach's evil, it's here. What did Ephraim do in the end? B'sach HaKol, they came to say they wanted to be part of the battle.
Too little.
And the result was?
They killed them.
They slaughtered them.
That's really stupid.
Vayishpot, and the story ends, Vayishpot Yiftachet Yisrael Sheish Shanim. Yiftach judged Israel for 6 years, Vayamot Yiftachet Giladi, Vayikaveh Bar Gilad. End of story. Yiftach died, he was buried in the cities of Gilad. Next story.
It's just 42,000 people.
That's how it ends. It ends with the slaughter of Bnei Ephraim. Which means, and it's very, very, I think very specific, the tragedy of Yiftach is far less the story of Bat Yiftach as it is the slaughter of 42,000 Ephraimites. You get a very good sense of the depth of an individual, and you ask the question, how could Yiftach do this to his daughter? I'm not surprised that Yiftach could do that to his daughter.
But that's only because you hear the rest of the story.
Correct. You could slaughter 42,000 innocent Ephraimites because they can't pronounce the word Shibboleth properly. You want to talk about ethnic cleansing? The evil of Yiftach reeks. And the mystery is, was it really so simple as a function of they came to Yiftach and they said we wanted to be part of the war? Is that really a justification for Yiftach? Why couldn't Yiftach respond the way Gideon responded to Bnei Ephraim? Hey, wonderful, go for it. Look what your God did for you.
This is a show.
Gideon
sounds like a real prince.
Yeah. That's right. Gideon sounds like a real prince, right? And the truth is that there are many parallels. Right? We're talking about Bnei Ephraim. Gideon was from Shevet Menashe. Yiftach HaGiladi is from Shevet Menashe, though opposite sides of the Arden Menashe, but right. Still the same tribe. Brother against brother. They call them to they're arguing they want to be called to war. However, yeah.
Why would he kill them?
That's a mystery. Why would he kill them? And the mystery is exacerbated by the placement of a verse which makes no sense whatsoever, which we're going to come back to in a second. But the truth is, but the truth, there must be a reason. Yeah. There has to be a reason.
He had to muster more than 42,000 people of his own to kill these people. Like,
oh, yeah, you had to have an army.
They were willing to.
He had to have an army, correct. Well, exactly right. We're willing to participate. And it can't be personal. Right, it was a slaughter.
Right.
It can't. Had to be something going on here, right? Yeah.
But now, you say 42,000 people killed, and then they just talk about how long he ruled, and that's the end of it. I mean, right. You just don't kill 42,000, and that's it.
Yeah, you do if you solve your problem.
Why do 42,000 people
you
go
do
on,
if after the, you,
battle?
You do it by the end of the slaughter, the 42,000, your problem has been solved.
But
this is...
That depends on how you look at it.
Right.
Now, let's go back one step. We started by a comparison of Yiftach's negotiation with Bnei Ephraim to Gideon's negotiation with Bnei Ephraim. However, it's not completely a fair comparison. Why is it not a fair comparison? Because there are a number of very different circumstances here. First of all, Bnei Ephraim, when they come to Gideon, they never threatened him. They spoke harshly, they fought with him, but they never threatened him. Bnei Ephraim threatened Yiftach. Betcha nisrof alecha ba'esh. They threatened him. Which is a pretty stupid thing to do for Yiftach, but nonetheless, you have to remember that Bnei Ephraim start with a threat. Number two, Gideon had engaged Ephraim in the battle. Whereas Yiftach never did. Right? So the circumstances of the complaint of Bnei Ephraim are different. And the third most important distinction is that we're talking about two opposite tribes. Menashe East is not the same as Menashe West. Gideon came from Aviezer, which is from the tribe of Menashe on the west side of the Arden. Yiftach comes from Gilad, which is on the east side of the Arden. How did Bnei Ephraim get mixed up with Chalal on the other side of the Arden? And when Yiftach says to Bnei Ephraim, for 18 years we've been suffering, and maybe longer we've been suffering at the hands of Ammon, where were you when we called you? Why would they have called Ephraim? Why would Yiftach, over here, suffering from Ammon, call for Ephraim to assist? He could have called from Reuven, from Gad, Yisachar, Menashe, lots of closer tribes than Ephraim. What business is Ephraim doing there? So some of the Mefarshim suggest that the real comparison is not between the story of Yiftach's attitude, Yiftach's response to Bnei Ephraim, and Gideon's response to Bnei Ephraim. But the real response is, or the real parallel is between Yiftach's response to Bnei Ephraim and Gideon's response to Pnuel and Sukkot. Because what happened by Gideon's response to Pnuel and Sukkot? Remember that part of the story? Gideon is coming with his army, chasing Midian across the Yarden, comes to Pnuel and Sukkot, which are cities on the border of the Yabok River. He's headed southeast, and he asks them for quarter for his soldiers, and they refused. So he killed them all. Gideon was no pussycat either. Right? He killed them all. He slaughtered them all. So, suddenly, a generation later, after Gideon is guilty of slaughtering cities on the east side of the Yarden, Yiftach HaGiladi finds himself in a position where he's being challenged by tribes on the west side of the Yarden. And you get the impression that the conflict isn't between Manasseh and Ephraim, but between
east and west.
Tribes east and tribes west. Between the leadership at east of the Yarden and the leadership west of the Yarden. Which may account for the Yiftach Pinchas issue. Because remember that Pinchas is in the Mishkan, which is in Shiloh in Shevet Ephraim, and Yiftach is in the Gilad. There's a tension that's been brewing over this Yarden division for years. Who's to say that Yiftach and his people of Gilad's response to Bnei Ephraim is not 10 times harsher than it need be as payback for Gideon of the West having slaughtered Pnuel and Sukkot of the East? Understand the tension line? This east-west tension is the source of a subtext through all of Tanakh, because virtually every civil war, virtually, not all, but most civil wars in Israel, cross the Yarden River. The boundary of the tribes, east and west, created enormous tension. Tension over leadership, tension over power, tension over the significance of the role of the land of Israel. So that may account for the Pinchas Yiftach issue, in part, and the harsh response of Gideon of Yiftach to Bnei Ephraim, as kind of a payback to Gideon's harsh treatment of Pnuel and Sukkot, which may go all the way back to Sefer Yehoshua, and will go all the way forward into the world of Tanakh.
Things are set up, and this is love.
Isn't it amazing?
But in Ephraim, the Ish Ephraim go with at least 42,000.
Oh. Now that's, that's a number.
If you're trying to negotiate something,
that's right.
They always teach you in fundraising, never go with more than two people because people feel like they don't have a choice. Then.
That's right. When you showed up, that's right.
You showed 42,000 soldiers going, like, I'm going to burn your house down. I mean, exactly. You know.
Prove to me from the text that Yiftach understood the delegation of Bnei Ephraim as a delegation of war and not a delegation of peace. It's clear. What you're saying is correct. The Bnei Ephraim showed up ready for war, and Yiftach understood that they were ready for war.
Right.
Take a look. What does he say? Pasuk Gimel. V'lama alitem ela hayom hazeh. He understood exactly that they had come to him to fight, and his response was appropriate, was according. All right, that's our first issue. Second issue I'm going to leave you with as a question, cliffhanger, for next week.
Is next week our last lesson?
Next week is our last lesson.
It is.
Okay. Correct.
For the foreseeable future.
Till we resume after the summer break.
That's a good idea.
Whenever that is.
Right. What I want to leave you with, this pasuk, this mysterious pasuk.
Dalet.
Vayaku anshei Gilad et Ephraim, ki emru plitei Ephraim atem Gilad betoch Ephraim betoch Menashe.
The outcast.
What does this pasuk mean? Is it a justification for the war? Is it an ex? What are the variable pieces that we need to resolve to understand what this, just what the word means? Vayomru, vayaku anshei Gilad et Ephraim ki yomru. Who's saying? Who said plitei Ephraim atem? And what is plitei Ephraim atem Gilad?
Ephraim
is saying plitei Ephraim atem Gilad. Ephraim's taunting them.
Yeah.
So you're suggesting that Ephraim, that the justification for the war is because Ephraim was taunting them, was making fun of them? What are they doing? Ki yomru plitei Ephraim atem Gilad betoch Ephraim, betoch Menashe. What we'll do next week is we'll start with the Mefarshim on this pasuk, try to understand the issue, and then I'll share with you an additional possibility. But I want to close with a quote from the Sinsinu translation. First time I taught this, I didn't have the Sinsinu translation. I had all the Mefarshim that we have on the page, and we have a whole discussion. And as I'm going through the complexity of this pasuk, somebody who in class had a Sinsinu English showed me this quote. I was astounded. I'm on the other side. In the English, where it has English text, the top, this is just a photocopy from the Sinsinu, where it says in the top, you have the Pasuk, Dalet, Vayaku and Shegilad at Ephraim, translated here as, the men of Gilad smote Ephraim because they said, ye are fugitives of Ephraim, ye Giladites in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Menashe, whatever that means, as I said. It makes less no sense in English, and more sense in English than it does in Hebrew. Look at the source, the footnote. Ye are fugitives. Modern expositors abandon the attempt to interpret this passage.
There you go.
This is the most difficult, one of the most difficult psukim in Tanakh, just to understand what it means. The grammar, the structure, the pronoun.
Well, you don't
what's
know who
going
you
on.
Is.
You don't know who you is, you don't know who we are, you don't know who's saying.
And you don't know who the men are.
And then in context. So this is what we're going to start with next week, Bezrat Hashem, and that will hopefully give us some key pieces to the last piece of the puzzle.
Stay tuned.